Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development. Monday, May 23rd. We have a number of interesting informational meetings today. We're going to proceed along the sequence as outlined in the agenda. So I'm going to open our first informational meeting on the healthcare workforce needs in Southern Oregon. We have Mr. Patterson, Doug Paxton, and Kelly Morgan. Are you all here? I see two of you, I think. There we are. So please come forward. I had the chance to visit Southern Oregon a few months ago and got a little bit of a taste of this, and so I'm eager to have you fill the rest of the committee in. I'm glad you're here, and please start whatever order you would like, and if you could each begin by introducing yourself for our record, that'd be very helpful.
Hello. My name is Wayne Patterson. I am the Executive Director for the Partnership for Economic Development for Douglas County. We are a collaborative organization focused on the retention, expansion, and recruitment of businesses in our regional area that provide family wage jobs. And Mr. Reed was just down. Had a nice meeting with you, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are spearheading a new coalition as Oregonians for Rural Health, aimed at working to diversify the regional economy to ensure future prosperity and growth. Today, I would like to provide a report on the state of Southern Oregon's economy as related to our workforce needs. Southern Oregon's economic crisis. For decades, Southern Oregon's economy thrived on timber and wood products, providing steady jobs handed down from one generation to the next. Yet, logging restrictions coupled with a range of other factors have taken a significant toll on the industry and consequently the regional economy and our sense of community identity. Scars of high unemployment and poverty weathered over the years across Southern Oregon run deep. Today, jobs are still tough for many to come by, and the future remains uncertain. New economic drivers are needed that can provide greater stability. In addition, family wage jobs are crucial to revising the region's high unemployment and poverty levels. We formed a collaborative group of community leaders, businesses, and other several agencies years ago to explore the options. Capitalizing on healthcare came to the forefront, given its strong presence in the region and growing need for services. But what became apparent is that there are not enough healthcare professionals to meet the community needs, despite recruiting efforts. No doubt, expanded workforce training in the region is needed to meet the growing labor demands of healthcare providers. And here is Southern Oregon's unemployment rates have remained high following the recession, despite improvements in other urban areas of the state. U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that the national unemployment rate is at 5%. Oregon's unemployment rate is slightly better than 4.5%. The unemployment rate for Portland Metro is at 3.9%, yet the average unemployment rate for Southern Oregon counties is 6.04%. At the height of the recession, unemployment across Southern Oregon averaged almost 16%, which is 10 points down from the recession, but still not good enough. The declining industry and federal timber payment issue. Southern Oregon has historically had ups and downs in its regional economy, especially given the cyclical nature of the timber industry. Market conditions, including building booms and busts, largely drive production and consequently employment and revenue. Adding the mix of uncertainty to our timber supply, particularly following environmental restrictions and logging and federal forests, since then, limited timber supplies have added challenges to the industry and led to mill layoffs and closures. Timber supply remains in question today. Timber executives and county officials have just issued warnings that the latest BLM timber harvest plan will cut harvest to a point where future downsizing will be inevitable. Vanishing funds from timber industry revenues are expected to lead the cuts in social services. And federal timber payments, which have sustained services, including schools, are expected to come to an end. What's more, investment in mill modernization and automation have increased output per worker, requiring fewer and fewer employees. So, healthcare projections. What Southern Oregon communities need are long-term solutions that can help diversify our economy and that has led us to health care. Health care has continued to grow since the 90s, even during the recession. Its more recession-proof vitality and strong growing presence in our region offered the opportunity to get Southern Oregonians back to work. According to Oregon Employment Department forecast, healthcare will add about 45,000 new jobs at a 22% growth rate through 2022. And it's not just a small number of healthcare occupations in which demand is rising. The Oregon Employment Department projects growth in demand through 2022 for multiple healthcare operations, including nurse practitioners, physical and occupational therapists, diagnostic imaging, radiology technicians are all projected to increase in demand by 20% or more. Enter the need for regional allied health medical college. Healthcare is a viable path towards the strengthening and diversification of Southern Oregon's economy. As hospitals and providers have told us, and the state data shows, job vacancies already exist in multiple high demand fields. The opportunity is to link individuals living in the region to those jobs through expanded workforce training. Our vision is to build a regional allied health medical college that would provide advanced training in multiple high-demand allied health medical fields. Students would come from community colleges and workforce training programs in addition to being drawn from other areas. The specific mix of programs offered by the college will depend on regional input as well as the capacity of the academic partner secured to take the lead in shaping and administering the college. We are in the early stages of this effort and need guidance and support from legislature to make this vision a reality. Thank you.
Thank you for the background. Who's next?
I'm Kelly Morgan. I'm the president and CEO of Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg, but also I have served as the past chair of the Economic Development Partnership. I've also served as the chair of the Industrial Development Board, and I'm currently the chair of the Southern Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is made up of Douglas, Coos, and Curry counties.
You have a lot of titles.
I have a lot of titles, so I think I work part-time at the hospital now. That's what it feels like. So Oregon's state economy continues to improve in post-recession. Yet, as Wayne has pointed out, Southern Oregon's economy continues to struggle and lag behind as it has for decades. Our once robust timber industry has dwindled over the last 20 years, resulting in tremendous unemployment and poverty rates consistently higher than the state and national averages. In addition, adding to the economic hardships, communities are facing growing shortages of healthcare professionals that limit access to critical healthcare services. Innovative solutions are needed to put us on a path towards prosperity and growth. Several years ago, community leaders, businesses, economic groups, educators, and others began exploring options to diversify and renew the region's economy. Capitalizing on the strength and vitality of healthcare emerged to the forefront of options given its strong presence in the region and growing need for services. Healthcare has posted consistent gains in job growth in the region and statewide since the 1990s and expected to maintain its steady expansion. Yet as healthcare providers in the region, including our hospital, we're struggling to recruit skilled professionals for a variety of positions, including nursing, physical and occupational therapy, radiology, imaging, and mental health. That led us to the idea of building a regional allied health medical college that would offer advanced training in multiple high-demand fields. The college is expected to serve a broad range of 19 allied health fields, including nursing, pharmacy, radiology, imaging, laboratory services, physical and occupational therapy, and mental health. Instruction will focus on bachelor's and graduate level programs. The specific mix will depend on the regional input from community colleges, healthcare providers, as well as the capacity of the academic partner to secure the lead in shaping and administering the college. We expect about 1,700 initial students to start. Students would come from community colleges and workforce training programs in addition to being drawn from other areas. Hospitals and other providers would have a reliable pipeline of skilled professionals necessary to ensure care to access for the demand as services continue to grow. Local residents, including high school and community college students, can tap into college as a pathway to secure family wage jobs. At a time when Southern Oregon has experienced a large exodus of youth and young families as they leave in search of educational opportunities and jobs elsewhere, we can give them a reason to stay. We are here today to offer a new path that creates educational workforce training opportunities to get Southern Oregon back to work in the growing healthcare industry while ensuring access to critical care. These economic and healthcare workforce challenges impact many of us in Southern Oregon. Starting at the beginning of the year, we have built a broad coalition, Oregonians for Rural Healthcare, dedicated to promoting the health and vitality of our rural communities, including our community leaders, healthcare providers, educators, and economic groups. You know, we have a series of strong letters of support from county commissioners, including Douglas County commissioners, Curry County, as well as Lane County, mayors and cities. And I think probably the highlight is on the city of Brookings, where the mayor actually outlined that they do not have a hospital in their area, so it's critical that they are able to recruit people to their community. We have support letters from every hospital in Coos and Curry County. And just a small anecdotal story, I talked to the CEO of Bandon Hospital, and I think if any of you are golfers, you know they have a world-class golf course. So when he's been down there the past couple years, he thought, well, it should be pretty easy to recruit. I'm on the coast. I have a beautiful beach. I got a great golf course. He goes, it is so difficult to recruit just anybody to Bandon. We also have support from educators, including the Umpqua Community College, as well as Southwestern Oregon Community College, and working with their presidents, as well as businesses and other economic groups. Healthcare demand has spiked in recent years and is projected to keep growing. National healthcare reform has connected large number of individuals with an array of services, and almost 95% of the Oregonians have insurance today. Plus, a silver tsunami of soon-to-be-retired baby boomers with increasing healthcare needs has put a greater strain on our system. Our hospital, like many healthcare providers, has expanded multiple services multiple times now in numerous areas, including heart care, rehabilitation therapy, orthopedics, imaging, just to keep pace with our growing needs. We've added more physicians and medical staff, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to fill positions, especially in the allied health fields, including nursing and physical therapy and occupational therapy. We've greatly expanded our recruitment efforts. We provide signing bonuses and engagement programs and internships. But recruiting continues to be an ongoing struggle for us, especially in competing with Portland and the other urban areas. Mercy is not alone, as is confirmed in the Oregon Employment Department's 2015 job vacancy report released last March. Year over year, Oregon's healthcare industry has topped the list of total job vacancies in the state. Rates to difficult to fill healthcare job vacancies were especially high in rural areas and expected to get worse. The primary reason cited for healthcare job vacancies is the lack of qualified candidates. What we need is a regional pipeline of skilled healthcare professionals, which a new allied health medical college can provide. Those who train in rural areas are more likely to stay and work in rural areas than those trained in urban areas. So for us to be successful, what we really need and where we need your assistance is to find an academic partner that can work with us. We believe we have an innovative approach for job growth, as well as taking care of the job needs and taking care of our patients in rural Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Morgan. Mr. Paxton, please.
Sir. My name is Douglas Paxton, Medical Center Director for the Roseburg VA Healthcare System, serving our nation's heroes. I'm responsible for providing leadership, strategic direction, and healthcare to a system that covers Roseburg, Eugene. In Eugene, we have a 120,000 square foot healthcare center. We just opened up in January 25th. At Roseburg, we have the major medical center there. We also serve North Bend and Brookings. We have outpatient clinics in both of those cities. And we serve over 26,000 veterans annually. Oversee operations with key responsibilities, including budgetary and operations, oversight to both clinical and administrative service. Last year, we had the honor and privilege of providing veterans with over 270,000 visits to our healthcare system. I've been in the VA healthcare system in various capacities since the year 2000. Most importantly, I'm a veteran. I served 6 years in the U.S. Army as an infantryman and received my care through the VA also, service connected. Assuring appropriate healthcare resources, access, and delivery in isolated rural communities remains a profound challenge for the national VA healthcare system as well as the private sector. And the rapidly growing and distinctive issues faced by veterans in rural settings are especially complex and according to the VA Office of Rural Health, most prevalent barriers to care across all studies include transportation to VA facilities, distance to VA facilities, a lack of telehealth services in rural VA facilities, a lack of specialty care and urgent care at rural VA facilities, inadequate knowledge of VA eligibility, benefits, and services, and difficulty in recruitment and retention of health care providers and allied health care providers. And I would say, based on my experience, that's probably the key difficulties, recruitment and retention of health care providers and allied health care professionals. Access to a full and comprehensive spectrum of appropriate quality health care service is the central challenge facing many rural communities. Veterans' rural health care needs, especially among returning Iraqi freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom veterans, present our communities, veterans and their families, and the Veterans Health Care Administration with additional distinctive challenges. Access is the key issue, and are often more complex and multifaceted in rural settings. Access to primary care and specialty care increased if we could establish and maintain a professional workforce of healthcare workers. Currently, we don't have that. Leveraging local infrastructure is an important strategy providing healthcare to our rural veterans. A partnership with a local college that could focus on the needs of the healthcare industry is greatly needed by our veteran community. We have specialized needs. Homelessness, post-traumatic stress disorder. We have a program called RANGE that offers mental health services to veterans in their homes, prevents admissions to the VA. These are the growing needs of our veterans. We can't get that care in the community. These are specialized needs that mandate specialized healthcare workers be trained. The top most difficult positions to fill for trained healthcare professionals from our workforce success and strategic plan includes physical therapists, occupational therapists, nurses, LPNs, certified nursing assistants, medical technologists, diagnostic radiologic technologists, pharmacists, psychologists, and other mental health professions. Just for example, in our clinic out in Brookings, we've had a phlebotomist opening for the past 15 months that we can't hire. It's very hard to hire healthcare professionals on the coast, also in the Roseburg area. Currently, there are approximately 26 million living veterans in the United States, with about 6.1 million living in rural areas. With measuring access to mental health services to veterans, rural areas typically don't rank lowest. Southern Oregon ranks one of the lowest in the VA's healthcare system. Given the increasing prevalence of PTSD among our veteran population and the often accompanying outcomes of suicide, substance abuse, domestic violence, and homelessness, the ability to see a provider trained in addressing PTSD is critical. It is worth noting that while homelessness was historically been significantly more prevalent in the urban veteran population, the issue is becoming an increasing concern for suburban and rural areas. Lingering effects from PTSD are often attributed as a significant cause of veteran homelessness, and the lack of access to trained professionals in rural areas is a contributing factor to the observed increase in homelessness in these areas. Access to professionals trained and working with PTSD and homeless veterans is highly inconsistent. A healthcare college could provide the community with its skilled pool of professionals. While VA has the most extensive expertise in evidence-based treatments for combat-related PTSD and other mental health illnesses, this expertise is not routinely accessible in many geographical locations, and the civilian provider community remains largely untrained in the unique aspects of PTSD and homelessness in a military veteran. Additionally, veterans of both sexes, but particularly female veterans, encounter even more challenges due to the potential effects of military sexual trauma on development and severity of PTSD. The Institute of Medicine has recently cited MST as an important risk factor for PTSD development in female service veterans, and a VA research study from 2008 showed a 59% increase in risk for mental health problems for women and experienced MST and a 40% increase for men. Accordingly, there is a need for trained in mental health and primary care providers who are sensitive to the role of MSTD in the broader issue of PTSD and related mental health disorders. This need is particularly acute in rural areas where the population of female veterans is rapidly increasing. The Roseburg VA Healthcare System currently treats over 1,400 female veterans in our area. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think you've all given good explanation of the need and the challenges you're confronting. I imagine there may be some other questions from the panel, but maybe I can start with one, which is just giving us a more sort of concrete update on your progress. You mentioned, I heard all of you sometime mention the academic partner. Can you give us a sense of how you're progressing in identifying that person, what the structure might look like, and sort of a status update? I think at least I can stipulate. I think I understand the need, but I'd love to hear some more about the status of your progress.
Sure. Yeah, you know, we've had some different discussions with different public universities, you know, over the past couple of years, but we really haven't sustained any, you know, commitment at this particular time. So I think what we're looking at is for one of the public universities that we can, you know, work in concert to help us, you know, put this together, you know, set up what our curriculum is going to be, what we're going to need to do in regards to accreditation, so that way we have some street credibility to actually get this going. Right now, there's nobody that stepped up that's made that commitment at this particular time. A couple years ago, we did look at the possibility. We have a sister hospital in Des Moines that Mercy College, which is a private college, had looked at possibly doing that, but they ran into some issues with one of their competitors setting up a campus, so they've actually stepped back away from that, and that's why we've kind of reevaluated that. What can we do, you know, here with somebody in the state of Oregon? So that's where we're at.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Representative Rudin, please.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your work on this. As a veteran and a solid member of the Grace Silver Tsunami, I appreciate everything you're doing. What I don't understand is how much, if I wanted to be, say, a nurse or a phlebotomist or whatever right now, what are my options across the state? Are people able to get in those programs now? And my understanding is it's really difficult to get into current programs that are in the state because there's a lack of available staffing for those. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, if we build it,
sure,
are you going to be able to attract staff to come and,
yeah,
and live in that area?
Yeah, it's multifaceted. I think right now is if you're trying to get into one of these clinical areas, it's very difficult because most of all the programs throughout the state are oversubscribed. And if you want to be a physical therapist or occupational therapist, even if you meet minimum qualifications, there may be 250 applicants. They're taking 25 students, so it's very difficult to get in. Obviously, one of the challenges is to make sure we have the right amount of faculty if we move forward with this. We've actually built into our budget knowing that we'd have to pay a premium to bring faculty on, which we think we can put that together. I think the other thing is making sure that we work in concert with all of our partners throughout the state. One approach that we've taken a look on this is especially for clinical rotations. Obviously, we can't, you know, take care of 1,700 clinical rotations at our hospital. So part of the transaction would be is if a community is willing to support a student or a particular hospital or a particular entity, what we've asked them to do is to sponsor the student, pay a percentage of their cost, but then also agree to provide their clinical rotation, you know, back at that particular facility so they can get the training. The other part, which Wayne has touched on, is that if these communities can select the student from their particular community, then there's more likely that student's going to go back. So as an example, if you're trying to recruit a physical therapist to Brookings, they can pick one of their local students, they support them, then they will actually sign a contract and go back to work at that particular facility for a number of years. So I think that's what we're trying to, you know, tie back in all faculty, all the community, as well as with the institution on it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson?
I'll jump in.
Thanks.
So could you, could you just detail what higher ed opportunities there are, or connections you do have that are engaged in any kind of preparation for either nurse, LPNs, two-year RNs, four-year RNs, any of that kind of programs, even down to just a certificate for being a phlebotomist that's pulling, you know, doing blood tests, that kind of stuff. What is currently existing in the region that can be a pipeline to fill some of these?
Well, right now, you know, with UCC and with SWOC, they each have an RN program. There's also some technical technical abilities on that, but nobody's offering any type of bachelor's or master's prepared. So if it's an AA degree, or maybe it's a technical CNA or a phlebotomist, that we can do that locally. But most of the difficult ones are all bachelor's prepared. And right now, nobody is really offering that in our particular community. So we're trying to recruit people from outside our state or even outside our communities. And that's where it's a physical therapist, whether it's a bachelor's prepared nurse, whether it's a master's prepared nurse. And there's really nowhere to go that we can get those particular students to come to our particular facility.
Just to follow up,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would suggest, too, as you engage or go forward in this idea about trying to raise up your workforce from within or from within the region, which I think is exactly what would be helpful there, that you engage the K-12 community, too. Because there are opportunities now through dual accreditation and other types of ways that K-12 can put a focus and begin to plant those seeds in kids as early as when they first start high school.
Yeah.
You know, if this is the track, that if this seems like a way that you can continue to live in the area, serve your people in your community, this would be the good course pathway to get into that would lead into a, you know, either a degree program, a certificate program, and perhaps then that degree that really you're looking for.
Yeah, that's a great.
It really is a holistic.
That's a great
vertical
suggestion.
Integration.
And we're tracking with you on the Workforce Investment Board. You know, we've selected healthcare as our primary sector strategy that we're going to move ahead, you know, over the next few months. And you're absolutely right. We've got to get, you know, especially K through 12 involved with these kids early to get them into these professions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gallegos, please.
Thank you. So you want to start a college, eh? Pretty ambitious, but a lofty goal. I'm particularly interested in really this last comment, last piece of discussion, in that the estimates that I've heard are that 1 in 4 grade school kids in this state are Latino. 1 out of 4. So when you're talking about K-12 and then trajectory into college or some of these workforce areas, it seems to me that should be a primary concern. How do we get those kids out of high school? At this point, 40% of those Latino kids are not graduating from high school. They're not getting into high school. So how do you anticipate going into the communities where you've got this low graduation rate, getting them into then these kinds of professions? I guess to me that would be a primary concern. That would be a primary issue as to where do we develop the pool for these kinds of professions.
Well, I think there's some – currently what we're doing on the economic development side is we've tied ourselves to K-12 programs, and we've tried to focus on how we can take and put together programs to educate in high school, ways in which that they have a job upon graduation. So we've looked at community needs, and one of those, as an example, is welding, right? Because we have boat builders, and we've got these people, and we have growing industries. There's a shortage of welders. So we basically went into the high school and said, what do we have to do to develop a program? How do you educate these kids in such a way so that when they graduate, they have basic training skills where they can go take one of these jobs? So we're aligning it. So we invested. We gave them the proper equipment. They now have a program underway. We still have a shortage, by the way. So we're still struggling trying to figure it out, which is where the community college has locked in. So they've aggressively stepped up and said, look, we understand some of the short-term needs you have. We have a long-term answer, and here's the program that we can develop and wish to create graduates. But it's all surrounding that K-12 student. How do we find a way? And I think that community needs and where the job opportunities are play a lot of this because our community is very unique. You know, we're not Portland, right? We don't have the diversity. So how do we train them? And I think that that's part of what we have to do in order to make this program successful. And that's why we keep coming back to tying jobs in such a way that a person that goes into this program knows that when they graduate, they have a job and they can stay local. And supplying the locals with a way in order to have family wage income.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
I think that sounds pretty good. I mean, I guess what I'm thinking about is along those lines, when you're talking about affiliating with some of the existing universities or colleges, it seems to me that some of them, we could look at some of them and see how good a job, what they're doing in terms of reaching into their communities and retaining some of those folks in those communities. And I think the community colleges seem to be a really good source for that kind of thing.
Representative Rubin, please.
Yeah, I'm glad this conversation came up. I thought about mentioning it earlier, but if you're not aware, there's something called the Career Technical Student Organizations, and there's a variety of those, so SkillsUSA, teaching organizations, and so forth, but there's one of the half a dozen or so that specifically addresses educating students in the healthcare industry. And so your tip for the day is check Department of Ed website, look under Career Technical Education, and look for the healthcare one, because it's, as my understanding, it's one of the fastest growing career technical student organizations is the one in healthcare. It's so great. They have curriculum. They're designed to work with industry. They get kids excited about their careers. So there's real great connections to be made in that area. And I couldn't tell you whether Roseburg has a program or not, but it's something that I would encourage you to address. And that's how we get that pipeline started, is through that.
Thanks. So I guess just to make one comment as a closing observation, I'm obviously not going to be here for the next legislative session, but I think one of the things that this committee, if it or something similar continues to exist in the next session, will need from you is a more concrete set of steps that you're planning on taking. I'm not going to ask you to speak for the universities, public or private, in Oregon, but I think future legislators will want to hear about that and about the funding sources and the rest of the structure. So for today, I think this was a helpful introduction to your efforts. Everyone here and others can certainly speak for themselves, but I think people recognize the need, and I think people will want to continue to engage and be helpful as we can, recognizing the myriad other things that demand attention and funding. So I appreciate you being here, and I hope we'll keep in touch and be helpful.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So close the informational hearing on the healthcare workforce needs in Southern Oregon, and open an informational hearing on child savings accounts. We have a variety of people who are going to help introduce us to this concept, and I'll just say as we get started, this is something that has really interested me for a long time. This committee has done work on the 529 college savings plan, but I think that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg as to what families and kids in Oregon and around the country need. So I'm excited to hear about the work that Neighborhood Partners and others have been doing. We're going to start with Solana Rice from CFED on the phone. Ms. Rice, are you with us?
I am. Hello. Can
Excellent.
You hear me?
We can hear you very well.
Quite well.
Yes. We're turning the volume down just a little bit, in fact. Let me set the stage a little bit for you. Having been in your position sometimes, I always find it hard to sit on the phone and not have any sense of who I'm talking to. So there are several of us sitting at the front of the hearing room around the curved dais. We can all hear you. There are two people at the witness table and a reasonably large audience who are all awaiting your comments, and as I mentioned to the other folks, if you can start by introducing yourself for our record, that'd be great, and we're eager to hear from you.
Sure. Well, thank you for having CFED. I am Solana Rice. I am an associate director for state and local policy with CFED. We are a national nonprofit, and we're so pleased to be with you all discussing children's savings accounts. This issue has grown grown across the country in interest from hundreds of advocates from everywhere from Oregon, obviously, to St. Louis, to Minnesota. I mean, we're just seeing a lot of excitement around this. So just so glad to be with you. CFED is a national organization that's been around for almost 40 years with a mission to make it possible for millions of people to achieve financial security and to contribute to an opportunity economy. And we have partners all across the country, and Neighborhood Partnerships is definitely one of the stronger organizations in our network. As I said, I'm Solana Rice, and if you're following, I don't know the slide.
Yes, I should have mentioned that too. They're moving with your comments.
Great. And so I should say that I'm Solana, that I am representing Shira Markoff, who has been working with Neighborhood Partnerships in a technical capacity, and it's just been great to be a part of their conversation. If we move to the fourth slide, where you'll see Oregon is a leader in advancing financial security policy, and every year CFPB puts together a assets and opportunity scorecard where we stack up the 50 states and D.C. to see how families are faring financially. And so we both rank 69 different policies across a variety of financial security issues, and we also rank 61 different outcome measures. And so, you know, year after year, we see Oregon with very strong policies, 37 out of 69 of the policies that we track. Oregon has passed and is really a leader nationwide. I say that at the same time, there's more work to do. Right? So the outcomes haven't quite caught up to the number of policies passed. But I think it's really promising, the fact that we're even having this conversation. Children's savings and really educational investments generally are one of the big policy priorities that CFPB is supporting across the country. So I'll take a moment and just describe a little bit about children's savings and how they work. On the next slide, you can see that how we think about children's savings. We use a broad definition because there are so many different types of accounts. We are more focused on the outcome. So we're focused on long-term savings or investment accounts for children and youth, usually ages 0 to 18. These accounts are intended for an asset-building purpose, usually post-secondary education. So those accounts are ideally meant to build for education. But we've also seen accounts that go for home ownership, business development, et cetera. We also look for programs that provide direct monetary incentives and savings, and those are savings that are built and added to by contributions from family, friends, and children themselves. So we see, you know, growing the savings is absolutely critical, and we also look for programs that restrict withdrawals for non-qualified purposes. So these are typically accounts that are administered through a program either at the city or the state level. The withdrawals that families make are typically brokered by a third-party agent so that we're ensuring that the funds are going to the correct dedicated purposes. We're seeing children's savings have a big impact. So on the next slide, you'll see that from studies led in large part by scholars at the University of Kansas, low and moderate income children with college savings of just $1 to $499 are 3 times more likely to attend college and 4 times more likely to graduate from college. And so the first question is, well, $500, that's not going to make college affordable for low-income children. And the point here is that it's about the aspiration. Children's savings accounts develop a college-bound identity for low- and moderate-income children and for their parents. Time and time again, we hear parents say, I hadn't thought about this being a reality, college being a reality for my child, until we started saving, even saving small amounts. So small amounts of dollars result in big aspirations. If we move to the next slide, you'll see that we at CFED have started a campaign. We call it the Campaign for Every Kid's Future. The goal is to have 1.4 million children's savings accounts by the year 2020. We have over 40 partner organizations, about a dozen political champions from all across the country, and hundreds of individuals who have signed up for this campaign in support of children's savings of all shapes and sizes at the city level, at the state level. And we're just so excited to have this big umbrella to talk about the growing movement of children's savings. With that, I actually will pause and turn it over to my colleagues, but just so excited about Oregon having this opportunity in front of you. And actually, just to tie it to the last conversation that you all had and talking about high school graduation rates, this is one of those tools that really helps, and we're starting to see kids get through and to college with these children's savings accounts. So thank you for having CFED, and I will turn it over now.
Thanks very much. I think maybe I'll just take a moment to explain sort of the outline so people can think about where their questions and comments might fit. Jill and Melissa are here to kind of, I think, give us a sense of the Oregon version of where we want to go. A couple of students that we'll hear from, and then an opportunity to talk about specific questions and so on. So thank you, Ms. Rice, for the introduction, and we're happy to hear from Jill and Melissa, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Jill Windsor. I'm the Financial Innovations Director at Neighborhood Partnerships, and I also staff the newly formed Oregon Asset Building Coalition. So thank you so much for taking time on today's agenda. What we plan to do today is share our work to bring children's savings accounts to Oregon. So I'll start by providing a quick overview and a timeline of our next steps. We so appreciate that Solana Rice from the Corporation for Enterprise Development, our national partner, was able to join us today to provide that introduction to the concept of children's savings accounts. As Solana highlighted, children's savings accounts have been demonstrated to improve educational outcomes for children and improve the savings habits of families. Following my presentation, Melissa Hicks with Self Enhancement Incorporated will talk about how children's savings accounts will benefit the communities with which she works. We're also especially excited that Carolina and Enrique Ruiz from McKay High School will give us their perspective as students who've received support similar to the support that's provided by children's savings accounts. James Barta of Children First for Oregon will talk about the need for children's savings accounts here in this state. And we do plan to be really respectful of your time and keep our comments brief so that there will be time for questions afterward. I can come back up to answer questions after our other panelists finish. But first, I wanted to take a minute just to talk about the power of children's savings accounts. The Oregon Asset Building Coalition has spent the last several months asking the question, what if every child in Oregon started life on a great journey? A journey that lit a flame of hope in every kid so that they could achieve the future they dream of as high school graduates able to pursue future education, then on to jobs as engineers, designers, phlebotomists. We know that today, in too many Oregon communities, children are growing up without the capacity or inspiration to dream about their future. Children's savings accounts are a way to fuel dreams. Children's savings accounts provide an opportunity for the state, for local communities, local funders, and families themselves to demonstrate to our children that we believe in their future and we're willing to take action to make that future possible. State legislative action on children's savings accounts can act as a stimulus and as an anchor for community-based efforts to encourage children in our state to dream big and to pursue post-secondary education. We envision developing a children's savings account system for Oregon that will allow all children to save for post-secondary education and that will serve children from families with low and moderate incomes particularly well. The Oregon system will link state funds, private contributions from foundations and community partners, and savings from children and families. Child and family savings will be encouraged by behavioral incentives and saving matches. Everyone we've spoken with thus far has expressed real excitement about the opportunities that a children's savings account platform would provide to the children of Oregon. We've brought many partners to the table to help us design a system that will meet the needs of our diverse communities. We are in conversation with community-based organizations, several financial institutions, the Oregon Bankers Association, Northwest Credit Union Association, local funders, healthcare providers, the State Treasurer's Office, and various other individuals. We've recently learned that technology platforms exist now and are being used in different communities, some are being piloted, and that those technology platforms would really help us to achieve our goals with this program. We expect to come back in the fall with a proposal to launch a children's savings account platform for Oregon. Our expectation is to launch in two counties in 2017, and we hope to do that without an impact on the state budget. We strongly believe that Oregon needs to take steps to ensure that every kid grows up striving to graduate from high school and planning on pursuing opportunities after graduation. We also strongly believe that children's savings accounts are an important tool to help make that happen, and we look forward to working with you to make children's savings accounts an option across Oregon in the years to come. So again, thank you for your time. We'll go ahead and pass things over to Melissa.
Thank you. Melissa, please.
Good morning. My name is Melissa Hicks, and I am the Empowerment Programs Manager at Self Enhancement, Inc., and I also sit on the Portland African American Leadership Forum as the co-chair for economic development. Just briefly about SEI, we are a nonprofit providing culture-specific wraparound services to African-American youth and families. Those wraparound services include in-school, after-school, summer, and post-high programming. Our age range is 6th grade to age 25, recognizing that we need to follow kids all the way through that college or career transition after they graduate high school. And as we were serving youth, we realized that we also need to serve the family. The families, African-Americans in Oregon historically have been left out of the economy. And so in order to make these gains in that lapse of involvement, we definitely have a focused intention on getting to our children, but recognizing their parents also have needs. And so we also have a community and family programs department that serves roughly around 7,000 families every year with anti-poverty, family stabilization, and employment services. And along with all of our youth services that I mentioned earlier, we do also have a SEI Academy, which serves grades 6th through 8th grade. It's a Portland public charter school, culture specific to African Americans in North Northeast Portland. And so something that SEI definitely believes in, and it's kind of one of our mantras, if you are ever up in the MLK neighborhood in North Northeast Portland, you might, during the summertime, it looks like a bag of Skittles just exploded all over MLK, right? So that's our summer programming, and those are our students in those brightly colored shirts. And on the back of those shirts, they say, life has options, youth potential realized. And that is something that we absolutely believe in SEI, and we feel that the CSA, the Children's Savings Accounts, will allow more access to that. So one of the gains that SEI has done, as you may have heard in the news recently, is we have pushed the graduation rate for Jefferson High School, Northeast Portland. It was at 56%, and it's now at 88%. So we have a proven track record of showing that we can get students across those lines, knowing that what students need to succeed is a caring individual, a support system to get them across that graduation line. And we truly believe that every student has a gift, and it's our job to help them realize what that gift is and realize their full potential. And so with that, we call our some case managers, but they're called coordinators, and they're that teacher, that coach, that mentor, that second parent sometimes that only parent in that student's life that really is there for them 24/7, 365, we like to say, knowing obviously that there's reason within that, but that's one thing that our students have repeatedly said is SEI shows up for us. And so with that, we believe that having the CSAs would truly give more access to our students in particular that would not maybe think that they're going to college. They, even though that's our role to get them there, the financial burden that's placed on African-American families is significant. And I think the disparities across the state showing that communities of color are very much in that low and moderate income bracket is can be seen. And so we're super excited to have the children's savings accounts, because in the work that we do, we see ourselves already doing this work, preparing students for college. But if we could have access to the children's savings accounts at an earlier age, we can also start that aspiration and that college-bound identity even earlier. So one of the services that SEI does provide is parent-child development services. And so that's for families who have children's ages 0 to 5. So that means they can still be pregnant, obviously zero. And we're with them for those 5 years and getting those children and families ready for kindergarten. And currently we serve about 100 of those families with 3 full-time staff. And we are already starting to do this work. And so I love that this CSA is coming to fruition, hopefully. And one of the things that we do is we do a Tuesday night parenting class. And the parents go into our large conference room and they're learning skills to deal with the, you know, the 2-year-old tantrum while you're out and about. And so one of the things that I notice is we're missing an opportunity with our children that are in a separate room engaging in different activities is an opportunity to teach them about financial education. And so we have created custom-tailored a curriculum that can serve an audience aging from, I don't know, 3 years old to 12 years old. And they're learning about money, but they just don't know it. We have them engage in these awesome activities where they're creating a wallet out of crafts. And then as they're talking, the facilitator is guiding them. Well, what do you need a wallet for? This is where mom puts her money. This is where the credit cards go. And like engaging in those conversations really early so that we can start this mentality and change of behavior that money is important and saving is important and you need to save for your future. So if we can have your 4-year-old then go home with you at the dinner table and be like, oh, well, where's my piggy bank, and start having that conversation, we can encourage folks and adults to really start saving and really thinking about their financial futures. And so that's why one of the reasons, many reasons, SEI is so excited to have the CSAs, because we could then leverage what we're already doing with the community partners that Jill has talked about, with foundations that do want to give us support and open up savings accounts for these kids that we're working with on a daily basis. And then during these classes, they actually have a goal that they're going to meet at the end of this. It's a 20-week class. So at the end of that 20 weeks, being allowing them to by their goal that they wanted to do, and being able to provide those incentive dollars into the accounts for the children attending a class, for the adults attending a class, they realize it's important. And they're starting that conversation at a very, very early age, and therefore getting folks to college with less financial burden and less debt, as I know very well. I have to.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And it's also a nice coincidence that as you were speaking, we were joined by some students from Willamette High School in Eugene. Mr. Nelson, thank you for joining us. I imagine some of you may be sitting up here before too long, so don't get too comfortable there. Before we hear from some of your students who are here, are there any questions either for Ms. Rice or the right two witnesses? Representative Gagos, then Representative Nierman, please.
I just have a comment. I'm certainly a fan of SEI, and when I was at the University of Portland, I would take my students every year, actually, to do a tour. So I'd really encourage anybody who's interested in education to tour SEI. I mean, it is a shining star. I remember President Bush used to have these light.
1,000 points of light.
Yeah, 1,000. I'd say we'd make this a Gallegos shaft of light or something. but seriously, I think it is a model for the rest of the communities, particularly, I mean, coming out of the oppressed African-American community. I mean, it's just marvelous the way the wraparound services are designed really to sort of carry a student all the way through and to really talk about that kind of shift in graduation rate is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So congratulations and thank you. And I guess the other comment I would make is that I think things are you're really hitting at a really critical barrier that just the belief, the belief that you can succeed initiates the hope that you can. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so critical. So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Nierman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation, and this is a real exciting thing. It looks like it can open up a lot of opportunities. What's your vision of how the money gets into the count? I think you said something about incentive dollars there, but are there different ways that the money gets into the count?
We're still figuring out those details. We do sort of envision this as being sort of three sets of money. So we're hoping that the state can sort of incentivize with the initial seed deposit. So we'd like to see a contribution from the state into an account that might be held in a 529 account, some vehicle that's sort of a pooled account holding the state contribution. We also want to give families the opportunity to save alongside. We're still sort of figuring out the best opportunities to make that possible. It may be that we're able to link a traditional savings account, or we may be asking families to open a 529. Then we'd want this third option that communities could really develop their own specific programs. So it might be that a healthcare provider in Portland wants to make a deposit every time a child attends their well child visit. So they'd have an opportunity to put that deposit in another account as well. There is financial aggregation software that can sort of link all of those and make it possible for the families to track those funds over time.
So they're legally separated, but that separation's kind of
there's several different models. I think the one we're exploring most deeply at this point is that legal separation.
Thanks.
And you may have already said it. I may have missed it, but just in part to respond to your question, some of the groups that are involved in the coalition include those financial institutions and others who have the specific ideas about how those mechanics work. Is that right?
Absolutely. I do not have the banking expertise. We have plenty of financial institutions at the table who are helping to shape this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Rudin, please.
Melissa, could you clarify for me, SCI's charter, you talked a couple of times, you mentioned African-American students, then you somewhere in there said something about other students of color. Mm-hmm. Who do you serve? If you could clarify that for me.
We are a culture-specific agency for African-Americans.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Withen, please.
Trying to figure out what to say here, but thank you very much. This is a different presentation than we have. Jill did mention that asking the state for a little bit of money, but I fought for many sessions to get personal financial literacy back in the classrooms. Mm-hmm. Very unsuccessful. We've had offer of help from credit unions and banks to help this. I actually was in class 2 weeks ago and attended a high school class that was doing personal financial management as an elective. It is a possibility of elective, but not a required course. Mm-hmm. You have to be careful here politically. I'm going to look into this. I think it's a great opportunity. Several years ago, Mr. Tim Nesbitt came up with a program for college called Share Responsibility, where the family gave some, the state gave some, and then other people or scholarships or whatever. But I think a shared responsibility is a great way to go. And I see this program as a shared responsibility. Mm-hmm. I think it will also make a college degree so much more valuable for the individual and for the society and community if it's shared. The value of something that's free, I'm not sure what value that is. Mm-hmm. I'm very supportive of this. I appreciate the testimony, and I look forward to hearing about the program.
Thank you. Other comments, questions? Okay, let's hear from your colleagues, please.
Great, thank you.
So we have Carolina Ruiz and Enrique Ruiz, please. I'm sure I mispronounced your name, but I said both ways, so hopefully one of the two is correct. Please enlighten us.
All right. We also have James Barta.
Okay. I wasn't sure when you wanted him to come up. That's fine. Please.
Good morning. My name is Enrique Ruiz, and I'm a senior at McKay High School here in Salem. I was first approached by College Dreams as a fifth grader while in the Boys and Girls Club. And so one of the administrators, Sharon Reagan, acknowledged both my sister and I and took us in a room and showed us the statistics of those who went to college and the amount of years they went to college versus those who didn't go to college. And so she showed us the numbers of income differences, and that left a profound impact on me as a young child to pursue college. when entering middle school and high school, in my high school career, college then became an inevitability rather than an option. When I moved to Salem, college dreams still kept in touch, and I really appreciated the support they gave me, even though I moved and they served Southern Oregon residents and students. I became more involved with other nonprofit organizations that that deal with college preparation. I knew what resources to look for because of College Dreams. I knew where to look, how to collaborate. When I became a sophomore, I had a lot of knowledge on the college process, on the idiosyncrasies of each university and college throughout the state and throughout the country. As a senior now, I've made friends with the people within different college preparatory programs, and I've become so knowledgeable on the college process that I am now I'm preparing to go to Western Oregon University and transfer to University of Oregon to pursue a political science degree in American politics and government, and potentially going to graduate school to become a lawyer.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing your story.
All right. Good morning. My name is Carolina Ruiz, and I'm a junior at McKay High School and future ASB president of McKay High School. I don't know, just to put that out there. And so, like Enrique said, we were both approached by a coordinator from College Dreams named Sharon Reagan. And so, like Enrique said, you know, she showed us a pamphlet showing us, like, the statistics on how valuable college is, and that kind of, like, sparked the idea of college because when we were younger, we were told, do good in school, you'll be good. But then that didn't really show, like, we didn't really have a clear understanding of that. We didn't see the significance in that. And moving forward with College Dreams, like, we were offered, they opened up scholarships to us. They offered us college trips to see universities, to see how it works. We were able to walk around, like, gain that experience, gain that, like, know more about the environment, how it's like to be in a university. And so that kept the spark going, that ignited, like, the flame of college and university. And moving up here to Salem, it was, like, a little difficult because we didn't know if College Dreams was gonna keep in touch, but then luckily they did. And then my brother and I were thankfully introduced to Upward Bound, which is another nonprofit, and they were also able to make sure that our road to college and university was gonna remain stable and was going to make us successful as students. And I think that idea personally helped me because moving here to Salem as a freshman, I didn't know anybody. I was confused. How am I gonna make my friends? I just took the risk on running for our student government, and luckily I was elected, and now next upcoming year I'm going to be able to be the ASB president. But I think it's not just for the whole it looks good on your college application. It's not, it looks good for a resume. I think it's all about knowing oneself and being able to reach that self-fulfillment, because college and university, it's about reaching that self-fulfillment that everyone strives for, because everyone says it's a learning experience. It's about learning who you are and about how encompassing that kind of that person who you want to be and finding out what you aspire to be. So I think College Dreams and Upward Bound and other nonprofits have helped us students to reach that.
So before we go to James, one question about your experience, maybe in your experiences or in your observation of your classmates and acquaintances' experiences, what role has the understanding of your and your family's preparations from a financial sense played a role? Is more access to savings vehicles going to, do you think that's going to help other students?
Do you want to speak?
Regarding my family, we had no financial plan at all. We were just told, do well in school and leave the rest later for when you're older, for when you go to college. I strongly feel that with a savings account, we have a set foundation to build upon rather than just starting from scratch at a very later time, right before college.
From College Dreams, the nonprofit that we were part of and still continue to be part of from Southern Oregon and Grants Pass, they offered us scholarships, and then with that we were able to get practice with scholarship writing, and I know, like, personally, so I was able to receive a few scholarships, and that alone helped me kind of grasp onto the fact that college is possible. I already have this money set aside specifically for college, and I know I can reach my goal through that. In addition to a child savings account that they also offered to both of us, because we are from a low-income household, and with that we would save up to $3,000 to where they match it by multiplying by three, and so having the $9,000 while also adding the initial $3,000 to make $12,000. So that too has also kind of reassured our family into knowing that, okay, with the scholarships that that we are hopefully going to get, and with other things that we applied for, like grants and such, we know that we at least have this money to fall back on.
That's great. And do you think that experience is typical? Your classmates and friends and families, similar situations?
I think that, like, as far as I'm having that money to, like, fall back on, I know it's, like, really difficult for, because all of our friends, like, at McKay High School are, the majority of us are minorities, and so it is really hard to think about the financial aspect of going to university, and I think for the majority of us, we don't have that. They don't have that money to fall back on, and, like, we're thankful every day that we do. And so I think with, like, child savings accounts, being able to start early, that would spark the idea of college and university to be able to help all of us.
Thank you.
I have a specific friend who I talked to. He really wanted to go to OSU, but since he's a first generation, didn't really have much saved up and couldn't get enough scholarships to go to school, he had to deny the request for going to the university he wanted to be an engineer for OSU, so instead he has to go to community college for his first 2 years to save money.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad he's making that step, though, too, but I hear you. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Gallegos, please.
Yeah, I want to thank both of you for, one, being here, and you did a great job.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that your investment, and it's inevitable that you're going to be up here or you follow this path that you're already on. I just want to point out for the rest of the state that, you know, we've invested state money, we've invested foundation money in you, and you're going to pay us back. You're going to pay us back. Even in the salaries that you're able to earn with the degrees you get, with the college, as opposed to not even graduating out of high school, as we pointed out, so many are not, the salaries you make are going to be higher and you're going to pay greater taxes. Mm-hmm. So you'll pay us back. So thank you very much.
Thank you. James, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Members of the committee, my name is James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon, and we work with 80-plus organizations in United for Kids. And I just want to start out by saying that there's the need for this program. More than one in five children in Oregon live in poverty. That's more than 180,000 children that are below the federal poverty level. And and these accounts are needed to allow, you know, they're a long-term solution, but they're a powerful tool that allow these children who otherwise would likely stay in poverty to work their way out of it. And I just want to point out some of the data that I don't doubt the previous two testifiers mentioned, that in the last three decades, in inflation-adjusted dollars, the difference in median incomes for college graduates and high school graduates has doubled. And so while there was already a gap over the last 30 years, that difference has doubled, and we so see no reason why that won't continue. And so encouraging youth who might otherwise not think about college to attend college is a powerful tool that we can now develop. So unfortunately, the two best predictors for attending college right now are if the parents attended college and the parents' income. So we're going to see this cycle perpetuate itself unless we take steps to break it. Now, a lot of the advantages of children's savings accounts have already been talked about. You know, they create some wealth, but obviously not very much. But the main thing that I just want to emphasize once again is they allow these children and their parents to think about college. And that's a powerful tool. You know, the evidence that we've been seeing is in some ways preliminary because we haven't followed any children with a child savings account for 20 years to see if they attended college more often. We see a lot of good evidence, though, even in just the first 4 years of a child savings account. Oklahoma has a program where they took 2,700 infants, randomly assigned a treatment group and a control group, and they found several differences, some of the things that have already been discussed, that the mother's educational expectations for their children, though, increased. Other things like symptoms of maternal depression decreased, and parent-reported socio-emotional indicators for their children got better as well. But one of the most important things that come out of the studies around Oklahoma is that even with relatively small seed amounts, the families of the children that had those savings accounts participated more. They put in more savings as well than ones that didn't. So you get the buy-in from families to think about college for their children. And so, like I said, a lot of this evidence is preliminary, but I don't want to wait 20 years for the evidence to be conclusive. And given the undeniable need in our state, and given this evidence, Children First for Oregon supports the continued work to develop children's savings accounts, and I think we will find that the initial cost of this program is minimal and the long-term effects will be great for our state.
Thank you, James. Yes. Questions or comments, this panel? We appreciate it. Thank you both. Thank you particularly both for coming. James, you're here, you know, ordinarily, so not quite the same thank you to you, but we appreciate your testimony as well. And that brings us to Janet Bird to wrap us up on this topic and answer the technical questions we might have. And
I'm happy to answer our questions.
Okay. You want to? Janet's not coming up, or no? Oh, okay. We had a little miscommunication in our preparation. Okay, so we've reached the end of the planned presentations. I guess the takeaway for me here is that this is sort of a preview of what might be coming to the legislature in 2017 as work continues to develop the specifics and mechanics and so on. Representative Wisnett, please.
Do we have an idea of what other states put into the program?
So it's varied significantly. There are only a handful of statewide programs. Nevada, I believe, was doing a $50 deposit for each child from the state.
What was the total ask from the state?
For Oregon?
No. What are we going to put in the pot to match and things like that? Are we looking at $10 million, $5 million?
The numbers we've run for Oregon, considering there are about 45,000 children born in the state each year, and we're anticipating asking for maybe $25 to $50 per child from the state. That would potentially be a $2 million investment per year.
Thank you.
Representative Geigels, please.
I do have a question. I mean, I'm curious about SEI as well. I mean, I just wonder if there have been any kind of longitudinal studies with regard to success. I mean, success can be measured in a variety of ways, but I would think that as I said, SEI, you don't have any long-term effects or...
There have been some long-term studies on the impacts of having savings set aside for college, not specifically children's savings accounts because they're a little bit too new for that type of research, but the research into having money set aside for college has indicated that for children from families with low to moderate incomes, they're three times more likely to attend college and four times more likely to graduate from college. We know that a lot of children might get to college, but then they drop out because of the financial burden, because they aren't academically prepared. So having that little bit of savings set aside, it's not even very much savings, will really increase the likelihood that a child will get to and through college.
Representative Rudin, please.
How would this fit in with the IDA accounts, or is there a connection?
Absolutely. So both Carolina and Enrique are enrolled in the IDA program. We really see this as being a tool that other programs can layer on top of. So we want to sort of create a base account, an opportunity for families and children to start participating early. And then if a child chooses to join the IDA program at age 12, they can also start to save alongside that. So we think that local communities and programs that currently exist, we really want to leverage all of the resources that currently exist.
Thank you.
So Jill, was it please?
So how did you guys learn about the SMART, or what was the program?
College
How did you
Dreams.
Get in touch with the...
Oh, the Dreams. College Dreams?
Yeah. College Dreams, excuse me.
We were at the Boys and Girls Club, and we were approached by a coordinator named Sharon Reagan, and I believe that they had access to every student's grades and how they were doing in school, starting from elementary through high school, and they usually reach out to the low-income students who have
So the Boys and Girls Club is your contact. Follow up, Ms. Chair.
Yes, please.
Have you taken the PSAT? Did both of you take the PSAT?
Yes, we did.
Because I've been here a long time, so. You know, we fund the PSAT, and the reason we did that was to help people like these two fine young people here identify that they may be college is an option. So I hope that the one thing that bothers me is, again, I spent last couple weeks ago in school, and the counselor at Bent High School was spending 80% of her time on social needs and kids on suicide watch list instead of helping kids get into scholarships or find whether they could get to college, and that was really discouraging. Because we're funding the PSAT to help these kids say, hey, I could maybe succeed in college, and that was one of the things. And I think that this is a good follow-on to that, but still discouraging as so many needs across the scope.
There certainly are a lot. That is true. I'm excited about this as an addition to the PSAT, a variety of things to help people think about what's possible for them. I think they all can fit together. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you.
Just a question, I guess. I don't know if anybody has the answer to this, but you know, we talk about, and I don't argue with the benefits of creating some sort of a nest egg, if you will. It's targeted towards education for kids, but I wonder if there's a way to separate that from just simply the act of creating a post-secondary going or college-going culture amongst the students. And specifically, I would focus on the AVID program. I don't know how familiar you are with that. We use that in our district. Other districts do as well. But that program, because of the intense nature of it and how it involves the family, the classroom, teacher, and the student entering into really an agreement, a contract, if you will, very demanding, very intensive, but it virtually eliminates the achievement gap in our district and in other districts too. I know Gresham Barlow uses it, many others, and there's not dollars involved, but it just points these kids. It provides study guidance. How do you take notes? How do you be a good student? And every student has to maintain this. It's just a up your game type thing, but towards the expectation that when you graduate, you will go on to this post-secondary, and the college-going rates are in the 90%. I mean, they're off the charts. So I guess my point would be, as a state, would it be in our best interest to pour more resources into this AVID bucket or something like it that would make it available to more students, or just this, you know, nest egg token starting point, if you will, it could develop into something, but it depends on how the family manages that, you know, account as well. So that's kind of what I'm, as a policy guy, that's kind of what I'm thinking about as we think about next session. What's the best way to go?
Is it fair to react to that with sort of is this an all of the above strategy, a question of where best to put our resources? But if I'm hearing you right, you're not necessarily criticizing anything, but asking what's the most efficient use of money?
I guess, Mr. Chair, I would say that simply creating an account, I think, doesn't go as far as some other programs do in preparing that student for success.
Okay.
That would be my point.
Okay.
There's other things we can do beyond that.
Yeah.
Obviously, as we talk about, our next panel is going to be talking about the Oregon Promise, which will be another policy initiative of the government or state to, again, provide opportunities for access and to keep that affordable.
Right. Absolutely. They'll fit together.
Thanks. Not really a question here, just a rant. So.
No, that's fine. That's perfectly fine. Very good. Well, you've done a great job introducing us to the concept. I'm excited to follow the progress and development of the concept, and hope to be able to help, though I won't be here in this seat next time. Thank you all very much. We appreciate it. So close the informational hearing on child savings accounts. And I think given the close kind of connection between our next two topics, and Representative Johnson, unless you object, I think we should probably just open them up together and have the four people we've identified. So I'm going to open up a hearing both on an update on the Oregon Promise and on House Bill 4076. We'll start with Ben Cannon and Bob Brew, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and I'll let Bob introduce himself in a moment. I'm just going to provide a brief opening and then turn it over to Bob for some of the specifics, and then I'll finish up with our final slide and our sort of look forward. We're very excited to be here to report to you today on progress in the implementation of the Oregon Promise, the so-called free community college program that our agency and office are charged with administering. We understand that we were asked today to focus specifically on a couple of questions related to funding and sustainability of the program over time. So we're prepared in our slides really respond to the questions. Number one, will the funding that was appropriated in 2015 for the program, about $10 million, be sufficient to cover the costs that we anticipate for the first class of students, the first cohort of students who will enroll and receive tuition grants starting in the fall of 2016? And then secondly, what will this program cost to maintain in the upcoming 2017-19 biennium? So in a sense, what are the roll-up costs? So with that framing, I'll turn it over to Bob to introduce himself and speak in particular to the question of funding for the upcoming class of enrollees.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Brew. I'm the director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. I'm delighted to be here today. I wanted to give you just a brief update on where we are in terms of the Oregon Promise to date. The Oregon Promise application period was from November 1 through March 1, and we received over 19,000 applicants for the program. There are really three sets of documents that students have to do to participate in the program. They have to complete the application, they have to submit a transcript so we can verify their GPA, their high school GPA, and then they have to file either a FAFSA or the Oregon Student Aid application. So that
interrupt for just 1 second. I think Representative Wisner has a clarifying question.
Yeah, Director Brew, you went from 19,000 applied to the qualified was 8,700. What was the unqualifying criteria or points?
Thank you, Chair Reed, Chair Wisnett. So we had 19,000 submit an application, and I believe Ashley handed out a little triangle document.
Oh, okay.
So of those 19,000, then 13,000 or 14,000 submitted a transcript. To date, 11,000 approximately have filed a FAFSA, and then somewhat less than 9,000 have submitted all that documentation and have been qualified. Now, other than the top number of 19,000, all of these other numbers will change. Some students didn't have the 2.5 GPA by their seventh semester, but believe that they will by the end of their eighth, and so we've given them the opportunity to submit transcripts later, so that number may go up. Students will can and often do update their FAFSA through the year, so we expect that some students will either update their FAFSA or as we go forward, or file their FAFSA initially. We also require that they list at least one Oregon Community College on the 10 among the 10 schools that they can list for a possible school higher education option. If they didn't list a community college, then they weren't counted in that 8,700 number. But a student can go in the FAFSA and update that.
Thank you.
So I put some numbers together based on if all 8,771 students attended college full-time for the full year, what would their total tuition cost be? What would their Pell contribution be from the federal government? What would their assistance be from the Oregon Opportunity Grant? And then what would the Oregon Promise obligation be under the grant? Now, we know from over 40 years of experience with the Oregon Opportunity Grant that students that apply for community college, apply for financial aid for community college, only about 54% of them actually end up enrolling. We don't know yet how the Oregon Promise may differ from the behavior under the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but we have that in the backs of our mind. So we expect that not only will fewer students than those 8,771 students enroll in the fall, but not all of them will either attend full-time, nor will they necessarily attend the full year. Are there any questions about that at this point?
Representative Rudin, please.
The screening process. So somebody to qualify to be one of the 8,531 students has to have applied for an Oregon Community College, right? But you had a much greater number, 13,960, so about 5,400 difference. Was the only difference between the 13,000 and the 8,000 the fact that they did not apply for Oregon Community College? Or is there a difference between, is it the 10 and the 8? What I'm trying to wonder is, can somebody come back in and change their application, say, oops, forgot that Oregon Community College part, can I get back in, and thereby elevate the number from 8,000 to some greater number?
Yes, Chair Reed, Representative Reardon, thank you for the question. Yes, you're right, one technical difference. The 13,000 have submitted a transcript. The difference between that and the 8,000 is they've also submitted a FAFSA, mm-hmm. and that FAFSA also contains the name of at least one Oregon Community College. Yes, a student could come in now and submit their FAFSA and include a community college, and that number would absolutely go up.
Okay, thank you.
The others? Okay, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so I'll spend a moment looking forward, and I think this is both exciting and important to think about the future of this program. So let me walk through this chart a little bit. It's not perhaps self-explanatory, but I think you'll get your minds around it pretty quickly. So as you know, $10 million were appropriated for the upcoming fiscal year 2016-17 to support the first cohort of students. These are students who graduated in the high school class of 2016 or just completed their GED, and we're calling them cohort one. And that reflects the total biennial cost in the current biennium of the program. I'll note that we're also covering our agency's considerable administrative efforts, although not considerable administrative costs. We'd love to tell you that story of how we've kept the agency costs for operating this program to within a very small amount of that total $10 million that was appropriated. But that $10 million is the current biennial appropriation. And as you look at that cohort, we expect that many of those students, if not most of them, will continue for a second year of eligibility if they're full-time. It's actually up to 90 credit hours, so it could be for longer if they're part-time. But for simplicity's sake, we look at a second year of funding for that same cohort, that high school class of 2016. So you're now looking at the blue section. That's a cost that will be incurred for that cohort in the upcoming biennium. All right, so that's the first column, cohort one, in the blue, the lower half of this chart. At the same time, in the fall of 2017, we expect to welcome our second cohort into the program. And if the program's terms and eligibility are unchanged or change very little, that cost, too, can be predicted to be somewhere in that $10 million range. Now look towards the so the total 2017-18 in a single academic year, the cost of this program, which was $10 million for the first year, has jumped to $20 million as two cohorts are simultaneously benefiting from the program. Look forward to 2018-19, the second year of the biennium. That second cohort is in its second year, and we're welcoming a third cohort in the fall of 2018. It's as a result of these sort of this mechanics that the biennial cost of this program, we predict, will rise from $10 million in the current biennium to $40 million in the 2017-19 biennium. This is an important point, I think, because it could jump out at lawmakers as you look at a budget next year that will, at least we hope, reflect in our budget request, will reflect the added cost of serving these additional cohorts and will be a fourfold increase in the cost of the program from $10 million to $40 million, but that's as a result of the fact that it's only beginning to be phased in the current biennium.
I think that's important for all of us, not only just the way you said that, but in the way we talk about it. So it's not a change in the program, but continuing its effectiveness for people to make it all the way through their community college experience. So I want to make sure I'm talking about it in that way, and I hope others will too.
Mr. Chair, members, I recognize this isn't the Budget Committee, but I do want to establish also for the record or note for the record that the bill that was adopted, Senate Bill 81, actually established the funding level for this program at $10 million per year. The effect of that provision of law is that the current service level budget for this program will be $20 million in the 2017-19 which is quite clearly less than the cost of continuing the existing program. So to compound the confusion, I think, Mr. Chair, that you're concerned not to compound, we have this technicality in the law which will result in a CSL that is actually less than the true cost or the actual cost of continuing the existing program. So we're concerned with that, and certainly our agency will be working to advocate for at least a budget that reflects the actual continuation of costs.
So I think you're an effective second way, you're underscoring the importance of us talking about the true cost of doing this at the level that we, I think, most of us who supported it intended. Were you going to say something, Representative Rudin?
Just clarification. I just remember the $10 million number, and that's, maybe that's all anybody remembers. So
I think that's right.
What's the correct way to say that? Would it be $10 million per cohort per year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, that's correct, or you could think of it as a $20 million annually cost, because there will be at least two cohorts at a time.
Well, both of those are correct, right? $10 million per cohort per year, so when there are two cohorts, $20 million per year.
When it's fully phased in.
Right, I think you're right. Representative Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, and Ben, I appreciate the clarification, and I think what you also might be inferring is that it would be helpful if some of us up here, other legislators, might communicate with LFO about what the true legislative intent was behind Senate Bill 81, and we can certainly do that.
Yeah, I think that's
as they build their projections for the next budget.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. And one sort of final point, as this slide implies, our current intent is to open the Oregon Promise application process for the high school class of 2017 starting next fall. I want to dwell on that for a moment, because we will be doing so without the certainty or security of a budget adopted by the legislature and signed by the governor to fund that cohort or the first cohort its second year. So clearly we'll have to establish for students, some sort of caveat that this is pending a legislative appropriation. And we will appreciate any feedback that the legislature or others provide about that approach, but our current thinking is that the legislature intends for this program to continue. I believe that our commission will recommend that it continue, and as a result, we will be sharing with high school students next fall, high school seniors next fall, that they, like the high school class of 2016, their predecessors, are very likely, at least, to have this opportunity to attend community college at reduced or no tuition cost.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
That concludes our presentation.
Okay, very good. Any concluding comments? Representative Johnson, please.
Sure. So, Bob, just to summarize, I guess, your report. At this point in time, it would be your stand then that the $10 million looks to be adequate for this current cohort that has applied for the Oregon Promise. Is that correct?
That's correct.
At what point chronologically do you anticipate most qualifying students will be notified of their award? I'm getting, just so you know, I'm getting a lot of feedback from constituents and mothers and fathers in my district saying, gosh, we already put down a deposit on housing. We haven't heard yet if we've got the award, and is this atypical or is this normal or whatever? So I'm just saying, are you about in the same time frame of award notification that you would be for, say, the Oregon Port or the Opportunity Grant? Or I realize there's other steps involved with the Oregon Promise, which probably delays the process a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we actually have approximately 19,000 emails going out today telling students how to log on to our portal and access their awards based on the schools that they've indicated on their FAFSA they'd like to consider. This was, I would like to apologize, this was significantly later than we'd hoped to be able to do that, but it's a new process and sure. We're getting better all the time.
So that was notifications you're going out really
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Be a hero tomorrow. You get your email out to them beforehand. I've taken care of it and
right
you should
now.
Be hearing from them soon.
Okay, well that's great. I appreciate that.
That's great. Thank you. Representative Wisnett, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either director. What percentage of the people that are getting the $10 million do we think will go to the second year? If there's going to be a dropout, what are we assuming?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Reed, and Bob may want to amplify on this. We're obviously playing pretty significant guessing games here and working with rough numbers.
Okay.
There will be some attrition. Some of the students...
You don't have a ballpark guesstimate?
Yeah. We can look at historical data.
Okay.
We've done some of that. Bob,
thank you.
Another way of asking that might be what's the
success.
overall rate?
No, when I'm coming to that, what is our outcome? What is the outcome that we're asking? Is 80% of these, you know, $10 million kids going to graduate?
Actually, I was going to suggest a different way of asking your original question, which is what is the attrition rate on community college students as a whole, and just as a...
We
as
know
a,
that was low.
Well, right. So it's probably going to be better than that, but that's a place to
start.
Well,
but follow-on questions?
Yeah, please, of course.
You know, this committee, we heard this, and we're all excited about it. It was based upon the Tennessee Promise. How's the Tennessee Promise going? What kind of attrition, what kind of success are they having? And one of my main concerns is the mentor program. Where are we on that? That's an additional expense to the $10 million.
That's what we're going to hear next. But,
okay.
But.
Where's the Tennessee program, I guess?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett. So the Tennessee Promise, they've indicated that their retention rates are significantly greater than for
average.
Prior cohorts. And I want to say in the 8 to 10 percentage point range, which when you compare
8 to 10 percent above the others?
Okay. Yes. Just as a follow-up to your previous question, that $10 million for the second year of the cohort, we are playing somewhat of a guessing game because we know that there'll be some attrition. At the same time, we know that there'll be inflation in costs and so on, and the program will grow in popularity. So without having solid information on any of those, we're kind of hoping there's somewhat of a wash in the big picture.
So, but again, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, of course.
Because is the Tennessee program back to where are we both the same? Because we thought they were going to be online before we were, but are they on? Mm-hmm. Are they online and they've had a year?
They're ending their first year about now. Is that
okay.
Right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, they are finishing their first year statewide, and they have several years of history before that in regions of the state that had done this, had entered this program. So there is quite a bit of data from Tennessee. It has shown a significant boost in retention and completion rates for those students. We're hoping to see the same in Oregon. You asked about the mentor program. Patrick Crane and Andrea Henderson will speak to some of the funding that was provided by the legislature to help support these Oregon Promise students. We are hopeful that we can, in an Oregon way, also provide levels of support that we know these students need in order to not only enroll but succeed. We don't have something that resembles or is identical to the Tennessee sort of volunteer community-based mentor program.
One final.
Go ahead.
As a member of the Ways and Means Committee, so you mentioned your administrative cost. So good. You want to tell us?
Thank you. Yes, I believe our administrative cost was approximately $370,000 for the program. We have essentially been able to staff that using our existing staff. I'd like to point out that between our scholarship, the group that staffs our privately funded scholarship program and the Oregon Promise, it's 9 FTE. Between the two programs, 37,000 applications. And so for the most part, that the money that we received was used in bringing in temporary staff, working part-time staff, full-time, mostly to answer phones, answer questions, and so on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you both very much. Ben did a nice job previewing our next stars, Andrea Henderson and Patrick Crane, please. So we're hoping to hear from you an update on the House Bill 4076, which we passed in February, please.
Yes, good morning. Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Crane. I'm the director of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development with the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Go ahead.
I will talk about some of the technical pieces, essentially what the money was for, how much we got, and how it's going out. From there, I'll turn it over to Andrea, who can provide a little more detail about what the colleges plan to do with this money. So House Bill 4076 allocated $1,659,800 to the Community College Support Fund for distribution to community colleges and community college service districts as a grant to every community college for the purpose of providing support services for persons who enroll in courses offered at a community college within 1 year of attaining the highest level of education described in ORS 341522, basically Oregon Promise students, recent high school graduates, recent GED awardees. So these funds will be dispersed in 20 equal allotments, one allotment to 16 community colleges, four allotments to Portland Community College because of their four campuses. And that allocation total is $82,990 per campus. So that amount is equivalent to a three-year contract with AVID that was spoken of earlier. AVID is a nonprofit organization that's focused on college readiness, retention, and success. They provide a variety of services, specifically professional development and training to educators, both in high school and colleges, on student engagement, classroom behavior, and learning strategies generally. So the colleges are not required to actually use AVID with this money. It is one of a variety of options that they may choose to invest in. However, they are required to meet the requirements spelled out in the legislation. And so with your leave, I'll provide some of that information. So essentially, this money is to provide a first-year experience. And there are some ways that should be provided at the community college level. So to meet the requirements of the legislation and this funding, the support services must implement proven multi-year strategies that incorporate elements of student services and faculty and staff development to improve academic success or completion rates, and must provide at least all of the following three things. One, a first-year experience for persons described in subsection one. Those are the recent high school graduates and GED awardees. These should be provided through a series of intentional, strategic interventions. Second, a student success team to serve persons described in subsection 1. And third, professional development for community college faculty and staff to enable the faculty and staff to provide intentional, strategic interventions to the persons described in subsection 1. So they will then need to report out twice to the HEC about how they have spent this money. The way we are...
Twice? Once every year, 2 years, or what's...
No later than November 30th, 2016, and April 7th, 2017, each community college shall report to the commission. So that's in the legislation itself. We have added a third reporting requirement at the very beginning as well. So we're sending the money out through intergovernmental agreements for $82,990. Those were sent out on May 17th, and we are asking the community colleges to describe their plans for spending this money when they submit their returned agreements. So staff at the HEC will review these. If we have questions, we'll contact the community college and discuss, you know, any questions or concerns we may have so that we know that they're meeting the requirements of the legislation. The following two reporting requirements are budgetary. We're asking them to let us know how they spent the money, and HEC in turn will provide that information to the legislature. I think that is sort of the nuts and bolts of how this works.
Okay, Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How you said how they spent it. Are you going to ask for outcomes or just, you know, I spent it for a classroom lecture? What's are you...
At this point, the way we have structured the request for information is that we ask them to describe their plans, how they're going to meet all of the requirements spelled out in legislation of multi-year strategies, student success teams, first-year experiences, and then the budget documents that we'll request should provide information about how they've invested that, whether it's with an AVID contract, academic counselors, et cetera.
Follow up, please.
Go ahead, please.
That's not a lot of money, $82,000. That's not one FTE. So, I mean, I don't understand, you know, how a college is I don't know how they're going to fulfill that obligation.
So maybe what we should do, hold that question until we hear from Andrea, too, and then okay. We can come back to it.
Thank you.
If that's okay.
Thank you.
I don't disagree with your perspective, but hopefully Andrea can provide some additional information.
Please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And so my role today is to talk with you a little bit about the conversations happening at the college level in terms of how they will use the money and what difference they think it will make. So first, the money really is critical. It's not very much, but unfortunately, our colleges have been so underfunded, every little bit helps. And the amount of cuts that we've had over the last several years have really hit the student services piece of the colleges the hardest. And so what this money does is it essentially allows the colleges to leverage the work that they're already doing in a way that can focus on programs to help those students coming in right out of high school into the community college to succeed. So specifically what the colleges are doing right now is engaging in a conversation in terms of what's that best use of the money that's going to make the biggest difference? What's the lever that can be moved to help change outcomes? Whether it's the term-to-term retention or first-year to second-year retention and ultimately the graduation rate. There's proven strategies out there around incoming freshmen that will help those freshmen succeed. And the focus of this money is really to help with those interventions. Probably the largest use of the money is around first-year experience. There's considerable data out there that first-year experience programs help students to both stay in school and to graduate. And so colleges are implementing that in a variety of ways. For some of the colleges, they've hired one FTE to organize and implement their first-year experience. That might be a one-week kind of boot camp before school starts. It might be an actual course that all freshmen take. It might be a one-day course. I mean, there's a variety of different ways to offer it, but it's a way to engage the students when they come in the door, and most importantly, for those students coming out of high school into community college, teaching them how to succeed in college. Mm-hmm. College is a different environment than high school. What are the study skills that they need? what are the different strategies to help them be successful in college. And so the first year experience really is around that. For some of the colleges, this money will be used to train a variety of faculty that interact with students in their first year. To help kind of embed that first-year experience into the writing and math courses. Some of the other colleges have chosen to go with Avid. We know so far that four colleges are planning to contract with Avid, with another three colleges looking very closely at it. So it's a variety of different strategies. Each college is deciding on their own how to best leverage that money. And we do expect that our retention rates and our graduation rates will go up because of it. And that really is the key in all of this, whether it's the Oregon Promise or it's the money to help students succeed. Now, are we making a difference? We hope we're making a difference. There's data out there. There's studies that show that these type of interventions work. We'll know more in a year when we look at what's actually happening with these students. And I think most importantly, we'll ask the critical questions of, if it's not making a difference, then what will? Let's not fund things that aren't actually moving the needle, but we do anticipate that these will. So the colleges have a very short window to try to implement these, but they do expect that they will have a first-year experience in place for this cohort coming in this fall. The other key piece around this is also advising. You may recall, in addition to the 4076 money, there was also money given at the end of the 2015 session to help colleges with advisors. And there was enough money that went out for our smaller colleges to have one new advisor and for our larger colleges to have two new advisors. So between those two pieces, they are really focused on bringing those students in from high school and to helping them to succeed. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Andrea, and I guess I'll throw Representative Wisnet into this conversation, too. But your point's very well taken that this isn't a lot of money. Yeah. But you may recall the Ways and Means process we went through in the last session, where I think this little nest egg, if you will, went from everywhere from about $3 million to $2 to $1.6 and so forth. And it's, your point earlier, your questions earlier about retention and how are we going to maintain these students in here, and the Oregon Promise isn't simply about access, it's about completion. Absolutely agree, but we have to, I think, set the hook with more people in the budget-making responsibility so that they understand that importance, too, because it really, really is important. So regarding the money, though, I would just say that, Avid does provide, I think, probably a pathway that is fiscally and financially probably maybe the best investment, so that colleges aren't trying to reinvent the wheel on their campus, but they can simply purchase those services that they need and let Avid do these on the scale that they do, in a mass scale across the country and in other colleges in Oregon too. So all that to say, we wish it was a lot more that we had available. Realities are what we were able to achieve. We're thankful for that. I think we've at least established a baseline going forward for those types of first year experiences, and the emphasis on helping to create better students so that they can be successful. But in subsequent biennia, we're going to need to continue to, expand this investment just so colleges are prepared. So however many of the 8,533 students arrive, we want to make sure as many of them as possible are persisting into that second year so that they actually get the completion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative, wasn't you okay? I think we're all agreeing with you.
Yeah, but thank you, Mr. Chair. And my honorable colleague. I voted for this bill, and I think it showed great opportunity, and I really thought the Tennessee Promise was unique in that they were asking for 4,000 volunteers that they were going to train to work with these, call them up at night, are you at the bar, are you studying, sort of stuff, right? We've decided to go a different way. I'm worried about it. To answer to the Oregon taxpayers, at the end of 3 years, 4 years, we spent $40 million, and we haven't, and this group has a retention rate of completing the 2 years of 30% or 40%. I don't think we've succeeded. I'm usually against pilot programs, But maybe we should have, in hindsight, that's Monday morning quarterback, and we should have maybe taken a smaller group because of the money and seen how this works. But we went all out, and I hope it works. I mean, I want more people out there succeeding and having a degree and making money and contributing to society so they pay my Social Security. And I have enough nurses to look after me as I get older and older. So, but I'm worried, and that's a big challenge for the HEC and for this legislative body that I think the counseling is critical. It's critical. Mm-hmm. So many of the people who are going to be doing this come from households where both the parents are working, maybe a language problem, all sorts of things. So I just thought, sure, $84,000 grant to a community college is going to help those kids succeed, which I won't. I don't want it to fail. I'm not asking it to fail. Just concern, my colleague and chair.
Appreciate the concern. I think that's something we'll all be watching, and we're certainly all agreed on the desire for success and improved outcomes. I agree with that. Anything else for Andrea or Mr. Crane? Okay.
If I could,
yes,
Sheree,
please.
One additional piece that as you look at the success of the program that we can say has made a difference is our FAFSA filings are up in Oregon. And so if nothing else, which I think we'll see other successes, but what we already do know is more people are filing for federal financial aid and more federal dollars will come into Oregon. I have some of my schools reporting up to 180% increase in their FAFSA filings, which is very large. And I believe we're going to get some news soon in terms of how Oregon ranks with other states in terms of increase. I think you have that already.
It's number one. Oregon has showed the number one increase in the country in terms of FAFSA filing.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Mm.
That was part of the hope for
We talked about that. The dentist on the committee made fun of me after I made that point on the floor that we'd go after this if it were teeth whitening. But it's even better than that. So that's great. Thank you for that information, too.
Sir, wait.
Please.
You probably incomplete information right now, I'm guessing, right? But is there any preliminary information or statistics you could release to us?
Can you send us that information? So, yeah.
Filings.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'll be issuing a release this week, which we'll make sure that you all get, that contains that data. And just to be clear, it's Oregon is number one in the percentage increase of high school seniors who are completing FAFSAs. That's the data that the U.S. Department of Ed tracks and reports annually to each state.
That sounds great. Thank you. Thanks for making that point. We might have missed it otherwise. Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That completes our agenda for today. Our next meeting is, of course, in September. Don't yet have a lot of information about what will be on that agenda. As you have ideas, certainly interested in including those. Is there anything else that needs to come before the committee today?
Good meeting. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Victoria.
We're adjourned.
Victoria.
Good meeting. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.